This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 233, was recorded on August 20th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by Masterworks.io, which brings investment in fine art within reach of all investors. Former hedge fund manager Jesse Felder returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from the stock market to the U.S. dollar to gold and even digital reserve currencies. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick and I will discuss equity markets, credit spreads, volatility, and the extraordinary contango in the gold market.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's just jump right to the S&P 500, because yesterday on the FOMC, we had a quick dive in the market. It wasn't that crazy. I mean, 50 S&P points or so. And more or less today, we've made most of it back. We're about 3380. I have some charts to share in the post game, but what's your take on all of this?
Well, you know, it's perfectly normal, even independent of the Fed minutes and everything else going on. You know, it's perfectly normal when you hit a resistance level, and certainly the prior all-time high is always a resistance level, you expect to see some consolidation for a while before you either break higher or lower. You know, it's got to at least slow down when it gets to that price, because some of the people think it's a double top. They're going to be selling it. It's going to turn down. Some people are going to get sucked into that. You know, you have to see what happens. So I think that it's perfectly consistent with an expectation of perhaps much higher prices to come that we would see a pause here at the previous all-time high, which is what we're seeing. Now, Charlie McElligott had a note out today saying that he sees a couple of different catalysts that could really go in either direction. So he's predicting next week potentially a significant move in one direction or the other. And of course, Charlie tends to take a fairly near-term view. Longer term, I expect we're going to eventually get through this level. If you look at what the other indices have done, the NASDAQ and the Dow and so forth, they're already at new all-time highs. So why wouldn't the S&P get there too? I don't see any sign of central bankers letting up on their stimulus, and that is what I think has been fueling this. And of course, I'll ask Jesse Felder in today's interview.
Well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because we started the week with a break on the Dixie to a fresh multi-month low. And then again, we had a big reversal candle on Wednesday after the FOMC minutes. What's your take? Do you think we're starting to get oversold enough to put in a bottom here, or is there more weakness to come?
Well, it's definitely oversold here. There's no doubt about that. The thing you got to remember is, you know, crashes don't start from overbought levels. They start from oversold levels. So oversold is just a technical term that refers to, if this is not the big one, then it's probably done being the little one. Well, we don't know if it's the Luke Groman moment, the big one or not. I doubt it. It seems to me like it is technically oversold. We're due for at least a bounce. But the thing is, I have to admit, I wasn't really expecting this much weakness. I thought that the dollar shortage, dollar squeeze argument that Jeff Snyder talks so much about was going to take us to a higher dollar index, and that has certainly not panned out. I'll ask Jesse Felder as well, but so far, you know, I don't really see reason to conclude that Luke is finally about to be proven right, but we could be seeing the beginning of that. Let's see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because we started to sell earlier today, and we're almost back to $43 on the upside on that October contract. What's your take on what's going on here in the crude oil markets?
Well, Patrick, it's two solid months now of sideways consolidation in a very, very narrow trading range. This is what a lot of traders call a coiled market. The analogy is to a snake that's coiled up, ready to strike. Question is, in which direction? Is it going to be a sudden big move up or a sudden big move down? And frankly, you can make the argument in either direction. big picture, Art Berman tells us to expect U.S. production to fall off a cliff in Q4. Well, it's still Q3. It's not Q4 yet. U.S. production is holding steady at 10.7 million barrels this week. So we're not seeing that yet, but Art says it's coming. That would say, at least in the next few months, higher prices should be ahead. The counterargument is from a seasonality standpoint. You know, end of August is usually where the seasonal top comes. Last week of August, first week of September. Then September, the rest of the month tends to be a sell-off. Now, that's seasonality that's based on a pattern that has to do with summer driving season, which may or may not be relevant in the midst of a global pandemic. With respect to the COVID-19 outlook, I see reason for probably, especially as we get into Q4, to expect higher prices. And the reason I say that is a lot of people are expecting a second wave to hit around October or November. And the more that I've seen in terms of data, there's lots of reasons to think that in places like Australia and New Zealand that have not really allowed their first wave to burn through yet, that there's still more to come. In places like most of the United States, where the first wave now finally has really burned through, there's a lot of new evidence saying that the T-cell immunity is going to hopefully save the day, and maybe it's not going to be as bad as we think. If that proves correct, and the feared second wave in the fall, a lot of people think, well, when the weather gets colder, that's going to be what does it. If you look at the data, this particular virus doesn't really show a lot of correlation with temperature. It does show some correlation from the standpoint that when you get to either extremes of temperature, very cold or very hot, where people have to be indoors, that's what seems to make it worse. But as we get into the autumn, there's no reason to think that temperature is going to, you know, make things worse, even though a lot of people seem to be assuming that. So I think we could have a favorable surprise in terms of not getting the second wave a lot of people fear, and I think that could result in increased demand at a time when supply is still really beginning to fall off significantly as a result of the lower rig count. Moving on to inventory this week, crude oil drawing down 1.6 million barrels. Now, that's the number everybody focuses on, and you know, it's a significant drawdown. The thing is, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which normally is the government's oil storage, but they've been leasing it out for private storage, so it really is kind of private storage at the same time. That was another drawdown of 2.7 million barrels. So net 4.3 million barrels of crude oil coming out of storage this week, another 607,000 barrels, or I should say 607,000 of those barrels came out of the Cushing storage facility in Cushing, Oklahoma. Gasoline drawing down 3.3 million barrels. Distillates was the only build on the entire board, and it was a de minimis 152,000 barrels. So you got drawdowns across the board. The drawdown on crude oil is bigger than it looks if you consider the SPR. Meanwhile, U.S. production, as I mentioned, is holding steady at 10.7 million barrels, unchanged from last week. Tape action, you know, that was a pretty significant bullish signal, you would think. Really big or reasonably big drawdowns across the board with the small exception of distillates. That causes the price to bump up as soon as the news comes out, and it lasts all of an hour or so. By the time we get to Thursday morning on the Fed Minutes news, we're down a dollar and a half. So it didn't last. And this market has really been frustrating a lot of people because it's been really showing a lot of signs that it wants to break out to the upside. But as soon as the move gets going, it always stumbles and fails and ends up trading back down below those key resistance levels. So it just doesn't seem like the energy is there for that upside breakout. Eventually, we're going to get some kind of move here, and I think it'll be significant. My guess is the market is waiting to see what happens with a second wave, and it's waiting to see what happens with U.S. production, whether those expectations of U.S. production decreasing dramatically as a result of the lower rig count and production declines really kicking in is going to be realized. And I think it will be realized, and I think that's going to bring us higher prices, but probably not for another month or two.
All right. Well, let's talk gold, because we've obviously for the last several weeks been talking about not only the parabolic rise, but inevitably that some form of a market correction was going to occur in the gold markets. And we will now are several weeks into that, including a pretty nasty break yesterday on the downside. Do you think the correction in gold is over? Or what's your take on all of this?
Well, it looks like maybe it's not over after all. And to me, I mean, as a gold bull, that's terrific news. The breakout area that this move, you know, started from was right around 1800. So I'd really like to see, in terms of cleaning out the system, if you will, a nice technical correction back down to just around 1800. And I've got limit orders resting just above 1800 to buy some more gold. There's more downside possible beyond that, but I think it would take a catalyst of some kind to really get a sell-off going below 1800. From where we are now, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon at 1955, you know, to come down $100, $150 from here, get to 1800, you're just a little over 1800, wouldn't surprise me that much. I think it would be good news in terms of strengthening this bull market by clearing out some of the excess that's existed for the last several weeks.
All right. Well, let's just wrap up by touching on the 10-year treasury yield, because we did pop above the 70 basis point level. And since then, we've been backing off. We are now about 4 or 5 days into pulling back. We're about spot 6.4 right now on the yield. What's your take on where we are with interest rates?
Well, I think everybody can't decide what's going on here. Is this just a pause that we're seeing in the bond bull market because the market's got to get through the psychological factor of, oh my gosh, negative interest rates are coming? Or are we seeing signs that inflation really is on the rise? I'm seeing lots of those signs. They're early signs, but it looks like inflation expectations, and certainly the rapid increase in the price of gold is one of the signals that tells us that. If we do think inflation is about to make a comeback, that suggests that bond yields are likely headed back up and prices coming down. So I think the market's kind of waiting to try to figure it out. And we seem to be stuck again in this very narrow trading range.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is former hedge fund manager Jesse Felder. Now, Eric, why did we invite Jesse back onto the show this week?
Well, Jesse's a really bright guy, and he's been one of our listeners' favorites for years. We wanted to get him back because Jesse has been a stock market bear for several years. And, you know, as we look at the current situation of maybe breaking out to new all-time highs, I wanted to get an update from Jesse on his perspective on the market, what's driving this, how long it can last, whether it's about the Fed or something else, and just seemed like a good time to get him back. I also want to remind our listeners, it really helps us a tremendous amount if you can rate and review us on iTunes. Help get us back into the top financial podcast list that we used to be at the very top of. The instructions for exactly how to do that, if you're not familiar with ratings and reviews in iTunes, is in your Research Roundup email. This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Masterworks.io. See disclaimer at Masterworks.io/disclaimer. And by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Jesse Felder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is former hedge fund manager turned Felder Report publisher, Jesse Felder. Jesse, it's great to have you back on the program. On the day that we are speaking, the global pandemic appears in some ways to be worsening across Europe with case counts on the rise, although we don't yet have death counts on the rise across Europe. A lot of question marks as to whether that's coming. There are a number of experts that are warning that as we get into the fall colder weather in the Northern Hemisphere, we could be looking at a vicious second wave of the pandemic. Stocks, meanwhile, rallied to new all-time highs on the news. Jesse Felder, please explain.
Well, it's absolutely astounding. I mean, you know, we talked, I think, last time you had me on the show, Eric, was February, right before the decline began. And, you know, you and I were both were very bearish, thought that that decline, initial 10% decline was going to continue. And it's, you know, I think even at the bottom in March and after, you know, a few weeks afterwards, nobody would have guessed that we would see the fastest, and a lot of people were calling the shortest bear market in history, which I tend to disagree. I think there's a good chance we're still in a bear market. But I do think, I'm thinking a lot about this quote from George Soros recently, where he talked about bubbles. He said, stock market bubbles don't grow out of thin air. Under normal conditions, misconceptions are self-correcting, and the markets tend towards some kind of equilibrium. Occasionally, a misconception is reinforced by a trend prevailing in reality, and that's when a boom-bust process gets underway. Eventually, the gap between reality and its false interpretation becomes unsustainable and the bubble bursts. I think there's just so many misconceptions right now driving this bubble. And it's also important to distinguish between a bubble and a mania. And I think, you know, the bubble is just price going, you know, two standard deviations out of its historical range, you know, a la Jeremy Grantham. We're well beyond that in the stock market. But I think it's more interesting to look today at these narratives or misconceptions that are driving the mania. Mike Green has done some work on, you know, the passive parts of this bubble and how passive investing is driving. But there's also, you know, a mania in day trading that we're witnessing right now. And I think that these two things helped explain what's going on.
Let's start with the Mike Green perspective. For any listeners who are not familiar, Mike Green has just gone from not a lot of people knew who he was to everybody talking about it. And I think that an interview that he did recently with Bill Fleckenstein and Grant Williams probably has led to a lot of that. To all of you guys that are bombarding us with get Mike Green on Macro Voices, we got it lined up. It's coming, guys, in September. So stand by for that. But I want to get your perspective on this, though, Jesse, because Mike laid out a thesis about passive investing and flows, basically saying, you know, this has gotten mechanical to the point where it's really not about anybody making some value decision and saying, hey, I really think the stock market is undervalued here and I'm going to buy more. It's more of just flows that keep coming into the market through passive investment strategies. Did you hear that interview and what was your reaction to it? Do you have any disagreement with Mike's perspective on that?
Well, I absolutely agree. And I've been writing about passive for a long time. Passive investing has undermined its most basic assumption, you know, which is that the market is efficient. Well, when passive becomes the market, it loses that efficiency by definition. And so there's a bunch of problems with passive. And the fact that so much money is flowing into it is absolutely distorting the markets. But I think it's those misconceptions, you know, that are most interesting to me. One of those is the price you pay does not determine your rate of return. People think I can literally pay any price for the broad stock market and I deserve a historical rate of return, which is exactly the opposite of what, you know, made Buffett such a successful investor. You know, the belief that the price you pay is what determines your rate of return. You know, there's also this belief that low interest rates justify higher multiples for valuations for those that are looking at valuation. But I think low interest rates help explain why valuations are extreme, but they don't justify extreme valuations. And all you have to do is understand a simple discounted cash flow analysis to understand this. Essentially, what investors are doing when they say low interest rates justify higher valuations is they're lowering the discount rate, but they're not also lowering the growth rate of earnings. And historically, I mean, this is something Cliff Asness proved a long time ago, that the discount rate and the earnings growth rate are essentially, you know, locked at the hip. You don't get faster growth, you know, without also raising the discount rate. And so, you know, that's just a misconception. And then if you look at markets like Europe and Japan, where you have negative interest rates, valuations there are much lower than the United States valuation. So to me, that, you know, that's another clear misconception. Finally, you have this belief that if your time horizon is long enough, as a buy and hold passive investor, you'll always be made whole. that you'll never lose money. You know, and even the history of the U.S. market kind of disproves that. You look at 1929, was 20 plus years of, you know, being in the red from the peak there. The late 60s, early 70s was another time where nominally you were in the red, and then in real terms, you're in the red for 20 plus years. And then just look at, you know, the Japanese market peaked in 1990 and still remains substantially below that peak made 30 years ago. So these are all misconceptions that are driving people into passive, but they won't be, I guess, obviously proven to be misconceptions until we come to the other side of this bubble.
Jesse, there's another aspect of this I know that you're watching, which is one of the signs that we're taught to look for is at the late stages of a bull market, it's when you tend to get a lot of new novice retail investors coming into the market, wanting to you know, get on the coattails of this big move that's already happened. And a lot of times that tends to mark at the top. Now, at this point, it's a little different this time in the sense that that retail mania actually has an elected poster boy named Dave Portnoy, who seems to be the representative of less than completely experienced retail investors entering this marketplace. Is that part of this? How much of a part of it is it? And what message does that really tell us? Because, you know, at the same time, there's also an argument that the reason it's working and the reason that a lot of these very inexperienced traders are making money is because there's a macro backdrop with what the Fed's doing that supports it. And maybe it's smart for these dumb guys that don't really know what they're doing. It's working for them now. Why shouldn't they keep doing it?
You're absolutely right to point out Dave, and I hate to, you know, probably call him out by name, but, you know, he reminds me of another online personality during the late 90s bubble. Tokyo Joe was a famous, you know, was actually brought up on SEC charges for a pump and dump scheme, but he became so popular for buying up, you know, stocks, small little internet names, then promoting him through his huge audience and then selling, you know, when the audience started buying. And I think it was early 2000, he was actually busted by the SEC. And that kind of was right around the top of that market. But we see a very similar kind of retail mania today. And, you know, I think we talked about it back in February. There was a great piece Luke Cowell wrote for Bloomberg about the options trading, the retail activity in options, and how they believe that they've found kind of a perpetual motion machine, I think is the term Luke used, where if they pool their resources, buy a bunch of call options, forces market makers to go, you know, essentially sell them the calls, their short calls, they got to go buy underlying, they can actually manifest profits as long as they're doing that. But I think, you know, there's another Soros quote related to bubbles that I think also helps explain what's really going on with this. And Soros said, when I see a bubble forming, I rush in to buy, adding fuel to the fire. That's not irrational. And I think there are a ton of quantitative hedge funds right now that are piggybacking on top of this retail flow. I think, you know, to me, the greatest, I guess, signpost in this regard was when RobinTrack was shut down because Robinhood wasn't sharing their data anymore publicly. I think last week or the week before, Steve Cohen's hedge fund and a couple others came out, mainly quantitative funds, and said, we're putting out an urgent request to replace this data that we lost, you know, with E-Trade and all the other types of brokers. They need that to see that order flow for their quant models. And to me, that suggests that what a lot of these quant funds are doing is they'll see investors rush into Apple shares and they'll just see the very beginnings of that and know that that's going to carry on for a period of time. And so what they're going to do is they're going to rush into Apple or whatever it is and add fuel to the fire, potentially through the options market. I've been amazed to see days where Apple trades, you know, 500,000 call options in a day of, you know, at the money strikes that expired that same week or on that Friday. And so to me, that, you know, that's 50 million shares of underlying demand for a stock for options that expire in a day or two. We're talking about Wednesday, Thursday demand. So, you know, there's this other dynamic where retail investors are pouring into the market because they believe this is a buy, you know, the March 2020 crash was a buying opportunity on par with March 2009, even though valuations at the bottom of March 2020 were 100% higher than March 2009. There's this other belief, you know, Dave Portnoy may be the one really promoting this. Stocks only go up. And it feels like that since March, but obviously that's patently not true. There are times when they don't. And, you know, finally, there's the belief that Fed money printing guarantees profits in the stock market. And I think that's the buy the dip mentality that we've seen for 10 plus years now. And where I think that is going to be, you know, proven to be a misconception is something that got a little bit of attention when Stan Druckenmiller brought it up a few months ago, but people have completely forgotten about it, is that, you know, it's not just Fed liquidity that matters. It's net liquidity. What is the Treasury doing? You know, you need to see what is the essentially the growth in the Fed balance sheet, less growth in the Treasury, because that's what net liquidity looks like. And the Treasury needs to sell $2 trillion of new debt in the second half. If the Fed doesn't monetize that completely, that's all net liquidity for the stock market. So I do think it's these twin manias. And I do think, you know, this is where I disagree a little bit with Mike, is that we've seen, I think this is where retail is picking up the mantle from passive. I think it's been passive for the past 10 years, but we've seen significant net outflows from equity funds, domestic equity funds this year and over the past 18 months or so. So when you have net outflows out of the market, how does the market go up? How do we get new highs? I think the only way to explain that is through this retail mania that's being magnified by quantitative hedge funds.
Jesse, let's talk about a specific situation that, to my thinking, kind of epitomizes this market. Just looking at my Tesla chart, it's not quite 2000 today, but I mean, it was a month ago or 6 weeks ago that nobody could believe it was already $1,000 a share for Tesla. Now we're looking at $2,000 a share, and it seems like one of the most ridiculous things you ever see in any market, which is when a stock split, which really doesn't mean anything substantive, it's just a change in the number of shares, and it means that the share price changes. The announcement of a stock split appears to have been the catalyst for a big move up in the price of Tesla shares. And that, to me, suggests a lot of very inexperienced hands in this Tesla market. But, you know, as much as it might be tempting to say, oh, it's a ripe short, a lot of smart people were saying that at $1,000 because it was a crazy valuation at $1,000. That was 6 weeks ago and the stock has doubled. What do you make of this? And what does it say about the market?
Well, a lot of really smart, experienced shorts were saying Tesla was a great short at $200 a share.
I was saying it at $75, and I still think it was right, but it didn't work out.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I think Tesla may be, when this whole mania is kind of in our rearview mirror, we'll look back at Tesla as the poster child of both of these manias, you know, that I was talking about. You know, there's another quote that I love from Scott McNeely, you know, talking about the dot-com mania. I won't read the whole thing, but in 2001 or two, after Sun Microsystems, his stock had gone from, you know, $5 a share to $65 and back to $5. He did an interview with Forbes, I think, and he said, you know, people were crazy to pay that for his stock price. It's interesting to me, too, because Elon Musk, you know, recently tweeted Tesla stock price is too high, you know, a month or two ago. So it kind of reminded me of this. And he said, basically, at 10 times sales is what, you know, people were paying for Sun. You know, he'd have to pay out 100% of revenues for 10 years in order to give them a payback. That's really hard for a computer company that makes hardware and has a lot of costs of doing business. I mean, this is even more important for Tesla, right? Because they have even greater costs of production, even lower gross margins than a Sun Microsystems, and it trades 14 times sales. So this is even, you know, so much more ridiculous than the poster child of the dot-com mania was. People are going to look back and go, what were you thinking buying Tesla? And to me, it's a testament to this retail mania, right? How do you get a stock like Tesla going through the roof? And I think it sort of disproves the theory that this is all passive investing too, because Tesla isn't in the index. So how does the stock go up if it's not in the S&P 500 index? Well, it has to have an incredible amount of manic buying. It also doesn't hurt that it has low float, because Elon owns most, you know, a big chunk of the shares. So it's very low trading float. But then, you know, you have to have this retail mania of investors just buying the stock, thinking that the price is going to go to the moon forever. And then, you know, there's this also this other misconception too, which I think helps prove the passive investing mania also, which is that, you know, they're buying it thinking that the price is going to go up when it goes into the index. And just the fact that the S&P 500 would be forced to pay, you know, to make this one of the top 10 holdings in the index potentially at a $350, $60 billion valuation and pay, you know, 14 times sales for it, regardless of the fact that it literally has zero sales growth right now, and there's no possible way to justify this multiple, is to me just the perfect example of that price insensitive buying that proves passive investing is a mania in itself. That it, you know, the system is going to force you to pay, you know, $1,800 a share for Tesla after it's put into the index. So I think it's a really interesting example of what's going on, and will, you know, prove to be the poster child of the current bubble that we're living through.
Jesse, I want to come back to stocks always going up, as our friend Davey Daytrader likes to say. You know, I was actually surprised in that series that Grant and Bill did, where Mike Green was featured and there were several others in the series. It was a dollar end game series, which we did on Macro Voices back in, I can't remember if it was 2016 or 2017. I think 2017 as our year end series. And they did a very similar series. I was surprised actually to hear both Grant and Bill express the sentiment of, you know, it has to end badly for the stock market someday. And I certainly agree that there's no free lunch and the story has to end badly. But I'm no longer persuaded that the way it goes down is a stock market crash at some point. It seems to me like we're on a path that's pretty darn clear from a social perspective that we're headed toward a lot more quantitative easing, eventually an MMT model where we're pumping more money into the real economy that leads to inflation. It seems to me like there's plenty of room for a melt up in the stock market where nominal prices just continue to go up, making Davey Daytrader look as if he knows what he's talking about, when in reality, what's really going on is it's the precursor to a currency crash. And we can come back. I've got some thoughts on how the currency crash might occur. But what do you think about the possibility that, yeah, the story ends badly, but it never results in the stock market selling off dramatically in nominal terms?
You know, I think that's a very interesting concept. And you know, the first person I saw propose that a couple of years ago was Luke Roman. And afterwards, I reached out to Luke to discuss it with him personally, because I do think it's an interesting idea. And even Warren Buffett has said, if interest rates, you know, stay low zero forever, then stocks are incredibly undervalued. You know, he said that a little over a year ago on a CNBC interview. But in that same interview, Charlie Munger said one of the greatest things that he fears is that governments around the world embrace money printing. This was May of last year. And obviously since then, the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve have dramatically embraced money printing. And the reason, you know, he said he fears that so much is because you inevitably get a Venezuela type situation. And so this is kind of what I think this idea of the stock market going up in nominal terms, but possibly down in real terms looks like. But I think before you get to that stage, before you get to hyperinflation, there'd be a lot of other signals to suggest that you're there. And those would be, you know, commodity prices rising. We're not seeing that. We would have to see the dollar really, you know, tank against other currencies. And I am a dollar bear. I think that's probably where we're headed. But I do think the only way that we're going to see that type of a scenario where you have a hyperinflationary environment that drives the stock market higher, as a part of driving everything else higher, is if the Fed is able to get away with monetizing. Essentially, right now, we're looking at $5 trillion annualized. If they get away with directly monetizing that much fiscal profligacy indefinitely, if they can get away with that without the dollar tanking, you know, then possibly it means, yeah, the stock market is going to just keep going straight up. Now, I don't think that's possible, but you know, some clearly do.
Jesse, something else that surprised me from that series with Grant and Bill is Bill's still talking up, and this is a tagline that I used to use years ago. Watch out, because the bond market's going to take away the keys to the printing press at some point. And I was surprised to hear Bill use that expression, because as I think about it now, and I was very much of that same mindset for years, but what I've realized is there's a strong argument that bond vigilantes, that's people who start selling bonds when they see that the government is being irresponsible, they can take away a government's ability to continue recklessly deficit spending. And in an environment where there is no central bank balance sheet expansion and no quantitative easing. But it seems to me that it's a completely false premise to say the bond market is going to take away the keys to the printing press, because in reality, it's the printing press which is the enabler that makes it possible for central banks to essentially, I would say, take away the keys that the bond vigilantes normally have to allow them to keep governments in check. Because it doesn't matter if the bond vigilantes are selling bonds, the central bank is going to print up some more money and buy them and support the bond market and support the government's ability to continue to borrow and spend recklessly. So I just don't buy this argument that the bond market will take away the keys to the printing press. The only way I can see that the keys to the printing press gets taken away is when you get runaway inflation. And that definitely takes the keys away and you got a really serious problem then. We're not there yet. And frankly, we're not close to that yet. Do you see it differently? What am I missing here?
I agree with you. And I think Bill's probably revised his view, you know, in light of the prospect of yield curve control. I think, you know, it's clear that the Fed is looking at yield curve control. They're not going to allow interest rates to go to a level that would be damaging to the economy. What I believe we're in a situation now, and I think this is what differentiates, this is a very important distinction, I think, between the money printing we're seeing today, really since last fall, since the repo crisis last fall, there's been a dramatic change in the nature of the money printing. You know, the money printing up until that point was really discretionary on the part of the Fed to try and boost the economy, try and lower interest rates, encourage people to take on mortgages and people to push them out on the risk curve, push up stock prices, create a wealth effect. What we saw with the repo crisis last fall was the demand for treasury bills just wasn't there. We had a $1 trillion fiscal deficit during an economic expansion. We haven't seen anything like that since, anything close. I think we had a 2.5% deficit during an expansion in the late 60s during the Vietnam War. This was pushing 5% of GDP during an economic expansion, totally unprecedented. And the only way we were financing it was through treasury bills. And the only people buying those treasury bills were leveraged hedge funds, you know, putting on the basis trade, borrowing tons of money in repo to buy treasury bills. When repo kind of, you know, started buckling, that trade came under pressure and the Fed had to say, there's nobody buying, you know, to buy these treasury bills. We have to come in and monetize this. And to me, that wasn't a discretionary move on the part of the Fed. That was the Fed being forced to come in and monetize debt that couldn't be bought by normal demand in the markets. And so that to me is a huge distinction. That to me was the beginning of so-called fiscal dominance, where the central bank can no longer decide what they want to do for the economy or inflation. They're essentially 100% beholden to whatever the fiscal authorities is deemed necessary. And we saw it again when, you know, Congress essentially voted to spend $3 trillion several months ago and the Fed had to come in. And why did their balance sheet go from $4 to $7 trillion? Because they're forced to monetize that. And so we're now in a situation of fiscal dominance where the Fed is essentially under the thumb of fiscal policymakers. And that's, like I said, a huge distinction. And I think this is where, you know, it's not going to be the bond market, because if they're forced to keep interest rates lower, it's going to be the dollar. Like Robert Kaplan, Dallas Fed head, said, you know, a week or two ago, that there is a limit to the money printing we can do. And essentially, the dollar is going to show us what that limit is. That, you know, fiscal authorities are going to do X, Y, and Z. We're going to be forced to monetize it. This is me reading between the lines. And the dollar is going to tell us how much we're allowed to monetize without the dollar really, really tanking. And I think this is why we started to see the dollar sell off this year is, you know, foreign investors concerned that the amount of money printing is getting out of hand. You know, you look at the growth in our monetary base was so much bigger in reaction to the pandemic than any other country on the planet. And people wonder why the dollar is going down. You know, to me, it's going to be the dollar takes the printing press away. And this is what I don't think a lot of people in the stock market appreciate currently. They think Fed money printing, you know, means the stock market goes up. Well, if the Fed doesn't print as much as the federal government issues, then the stock market has negative liquidity situation. And if they do print as much or more in order to create a positive liquidity situation for the markets, the dollar could really, really sell off. And that would, you know, I think that's already making the Fed think twice about what they're able to do.
Well, first of all, I agree with you very strongly that the dollar has the ability to take the keys to the printing press away, whereas I would have said the bond market doesn't. Now, you, Jesse, have been expressing a long-term secular bearish view on the dollar for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now. It seems like for a while, maybe you were making a good argument, but you know, it wasn't really happening yet in a big way. And certainly our mutual friend Luke Grohman has been expressing this very, very bearish dollar view that, you know, I've always been convinced Luke would be proven right in the end game. I just wasn't sure when the end game starts. So are we actually having that Luke Grohman moment where, you know, we saw 92 even on the dollar index on Tuesday of this week? That's a fresh low, and we're oversold here. Is that the bottom and the big bounce starts? You know, markets crash from oversold, not from overbought. Is this the beginning of something big, do you think? Or are we pretty much done with this move? Because certainly it's an overcrowded trade at this point to be short the dollar.
Absolutely. And I have been dollar bearish since late 16, early 17, really. And, you know, the dollar had a nice down move. And then, you know, since early 18, it's been in what I viewed as a counter trend rally. And I've felt wrong, certainly wrong in you know, being bearish to the dollar for the past couple of years. But this renewed sell-off, I do think, is just essentially a renewed down leg in the bear market that started in 17. Now, it absolutely is super overcrowded trade. You know, there are technical indicators to me that suggest it probably should rally in the short run. I think that could coincide with kind of a risk-off period for markets. But it's probably more of just a short-term, another short-term counter-trend rally in the dollar. And so how I would envision this playing out, and this is not a forecast, this is just, you know, how if I had to guess, this is how I would see it playing out. We're going to see a dollar rally for the next several weeks, coincides with a risk-off, maybe stocks pull back 10%. People are calling for the Fed, you know, whose the balance sheet hasn't expanded for 3 months. Fed's essentially on the sidelines. So stocks are going to have renewed sell-off, dollar rallies, and that's going to make everybody call for, you know, renewed Fed money printing, quantitative easing, whatever you want to call it, in light of the stock market sell-off and in light of dollar strength. And that's when the Fed's going to have to choose, okay, is it time now to monetize this $2 trillion the Treasury needs to issue over the, you know, by year end? And if they do make that decision to monetize the $2 trillion, then that's when we probably see the real big move down in the dollar. And so I think it's, like I said at the beginning of this year, the first market comment I wrote in January was, this is the year to watch the greenback. It's the most important chart in the market. And I still, you know, believe that over the next several weeks, months, it's going to be, it is the one to watch. So that, you know, that's my dollar view in a nutshell. But I'm curious to know, you know, your thoughts about the dollar, Eric, actually.
Well, Jesse, what I thought was actually missing from that conversation that Grant and Bill had is to really ask the question of, okay, what does it take in order? They both said, you know, it seems like in the end, it's the currency that fails. I just don't know how that comes about. Well, here's how I think that ultimately comes about. Why has the dollar been so strong and lasted so long and surprised so many people? The answer is because it's the global reserve currency. Well, why is the dollar the global reserve currency? I contend it is global reserve currency for one reason and one reason only, which is there is no viable alternative. So the process of logical deduction leads you to say, okay, if that's the situation, lots of people around the world are frustrated with the dollar's hegemony over the global financial system. But, you know, we're not going to go to euros and we're not going to go to yen and we're certainly not going to go to Russian rubles or Chinese yuan as the new global reserve currency. So the question becomes, what could happen to bring about, perhaps even suddenly, a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar as global reserve currency? That's the $64 trillion question, as far as I'm concerned, or $64 quadrillion question, is where do you get a suitable replacement for the U.S. dollar from to replace the dollar as the global reserve currency? And as soon as one emerges, I think the, you know, it's game over for the dollar. Luke Grohman gets proven right and the world changes in dramatic ways. Well, what could bring that about? And I think the big surprise, the fat tail surprise event that nobody's really watching closely enough for is the emergence of a digital currency. And I don't mean Bitcoin and Ethereum and the other cryptocurrencies, but a digital currency which is designed not to appeal to anarchists who are trying to do government-proof money, which is what Bitcoin was designed to do, but rather a digital currency which is designed expressly to displace the dollar. Somebody saying, let's engineer a digital currency system, use a lot of the ideas of distributed ledger and so forth that were invented by the Bitcoin crowd. But let's combine those technologies in a completely different way with almost opposite design goals of what cryptocurrency tries to achieve. And let's create something that appeals to the central bankers of the world. And, you know, it's easy to say, well, you know, there's nothing like that going on. Well, look at how quickly Facebook Libra came out of nowhere, had a big flash in the pan, and ended up dying out. Frankly, I think that's because Facebook had no idea what they were trying to do. You're basically trying to propose a new digital currency system which could eventually compete with government-issued money as a preferred medium of exchange and store of value. You can't do that without bribing a few politicians first. And I think that Facebook forgot that step. Who knows what Google is working on behind closed doors? Who knows what Apple has in mind after Apple Pay? So where I think the big surprise could come from is what I call an SVDC, Silicon Valley Digital Currency. Somebody in the Valley who's looking at all of this digital currency technology and saying, forget about cryptocurrency. That's just a little flash in the pan. Let's use these technologies in a different way to design something that really does provide a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar. And let's sell that to central bankers so that we, the creators of that digital currency, basically take on godlike status and are in charge of, you know, things that we shouldn't be in charge of. No doubt in my mind that that's what was probably in the back of Mark Zuckerberg's head. He did a very incompetent job of trying to promote Libra, and it was shut down very quickly. I bet there's other people in the Valley, Jesse, that watched that all go down, learned some lessons from it, and have plans of their own. And I think it's when they show up with a digital currency system. And by the way, the pandemic, you know, the old expression of never let a crisis go to waste, the pandemic provides a perfect venue for somebody to introduce something they can sell to governments that provides a way to take MMT, you know, helicopter money, and digitally distribute it to the populace. Well, we've got to adopt this new money system and give it government endorsement because it gives us the ability to, you know, basically achieve UBI and you know, all kinds of entitlement programs. Debit cards for social benefits and so forth are all going to be tied into this thing, and it's going to be all cool and technology's great. It's a great smokescreen to introduce a new digital currency whose real goal is to usurp the dollar's role at the center of the global financial system. I gotta believe there are very powerful, well-heeled people in Silicon Valley working very hard on that. And I'm watching to see who's next. Clearly, Facebook's Libra was not meant to be. Okay, what's Google up to in secret? What's Apple up to in secret? What's coming next? That's what's on my mind.
You know, that's a really interesting point, and it's probably, I think you're absolutely right, that's how technologies evolve, right? I mean, Bitcoin, it's one, I'm not a Bitcoin believer, just to kind of put that out there, and part of the reason is because you just look at how technologies evolve, and, you know, there are a lot of benefits to Ethereum, and why is Ethereum not a better cryptocurrency than Bitcoin? But you're right, all of these cryptocurrencies could prove to be the MySpace of an eventual Facebook that comes around that is the one that's adopted by governments, which I think is the point that you've made in your book, which is without the backing of major governments, you know, none of these cryptocurrencies have a chance in hell at usurping the dollar as reserve currency or even taking off and becoming widely adopted. I think the other point that I would make is that every time the dollar begins a bear market, people start talking about the reserve currency status and it being at risk. I mean, there's been plenty of times where the dollar has sold off 40% over a number of years, and it hasn't lost its reserve currency status. I don't know whether it's going to remain reserve currency or lose that status. I think I agree with Luke, over time it probably loses that status. But it's my belief that the dollar could fall, you know, 40% from its highs over the last few years without it having to lose its reserve currency status for that to happen. Now, if it were to lose 40% again, as it's done in the past, that might be what precipitates this transition away from the dollar and finally creates enough angst, you know, towards the dollar that, that people do look for a useful alternative.
Jesse, let's move on to precious metals. Gold market really breaking out to some astronomical highs. And then, of course, we had a significant correction, although, frankly, it wasn't that significant. We didn't even get back down to the $1,800 breakout level that had been the most recent proximal move up in the market. And frankly, we had never had a retracement back down to the prior breakout level before that. So what do you think is going on? Are we seeing a topping process here in gold, or is this just a little pullback and a buying opportunity?
You know, I've been bullish on gold for several years, and it's part of my, you know, that dollar bearishness thesis is part of this. But, you know, a big part of the reason I was so bullish gold and really took an interest in it back in 2015 was that famous Wall Street Journal piece calling it a pet rock. And when any asset class becomes that out of favor, it's usually a good buying opportunity. But then, you know, when you look deeper at, you know, what drives gold prices, it's real interest rates and it's the fiscal situation in the United States. And so I think what's been driving gold is that deteriorating fiscal situation paired with, you know, negative real interest rates in the United States. Those are, you know, essentially the ideal backdrop for gold bulls. And I do think this gold bull market probably has a lot longer way to go over the next several years. I think, you know, we talked about if the Fed through this fiscal dominance is forced into yield curve control and just monetizing a significant amount of debt indefinitely, that is the ultimate bull case for gold. And then I think in that scenario with yield curve control and the Fed, you know, monetizing trillions of dollars of debt every year, those crazy sounding forecasts of $10,000 an ounce or whatever, you know, immediately become not very crazy at all and become very realistic. But I think in the short run, I think we've seen so much bullish sentiment towards gold. It's become a crowded trade. We've seen money pour into ETFs. A lot of retail investors get involved. And I do think real interest rates potentially going forward could become a headwind instead of a tailwind. And by that, I suggest that essentially I think inflation could disappoint to the downside, that I think we, you know, with the velocity of money so weak and GDP so weak, that, you know, that tends to lead core CPI by a year to 18 months. And so I think inflation over the near term could disappoint to the downside. At the same time, interest rates could, you know, are starting to try and tick up. And so that's, you know, that is a recipe for rising real interest rates, which would be bearish for gold prices in the short run. So I think the combination of it being overcrowded and the possibility of real interest rates going the wrong direction in the short run makes me more cautious. I think we could have a corrective period that could last, you know, I mean, even in the last gold bull market, you know, from the early 2000s to 2011, you saw 20% pullbacks. And a lot of times that's what it takes in a bull market to shake out the weak holders. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that type of a thing over the next several months in the gold market.
Do you have enough conviction about that to take profits up here and look to buy back in at a lower price? Or is it more of just hold your current position and maybe add to it if there's a really big dip?
Yeah, so for me, I like to have a core position. I think gold's in a bull market, and it's so easy in a bull market to just sell out your core position and never get a chance to re-enter. So I'm definitely holding on to my core position, but trading around that with a more tactical type of position, I don't have any, I'm not tactically bullish on gold right now, so I don't have any tactical positions on in that market right now. That leaves me vulnerable to missing. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I've been cautious towards gold over the last several months. So, you know, I started buying it at $1,050 an ounce and, you know, started turning cautious around 1600-ish. And, you know, I've missed this last move up from a tactical perspective, but I'm fine with that because to me, it's about putting the probabilities in your favor. And I'm happy to just keep that core position on and look for a better opportunity to become tactically bullish over the next few months.
Jesse, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview this week. Tell our listeners about what they can expect to find at thefelderreport.com. And particularly, a lot of people have been a huge fan of your podcast. It's not quite as regular as Macro Voices. What's the strategy there? How often can we look forward to a new episode?
Well, yeah, not yet. I think I've recorded one this year. So
they're great when you do them.
You know, and yeah, you know, it's, for me, it's I have to be really, really curious about a certain topic and reach out to somebody to do that. And you know, it's probably a huge compliment to you that I think I've done two with you. And, you know, and so you probably represent 10% of my total library, Eric. But yeah, no, the Felder Report, you know, basically I put out a Saturday morning email, which has become pretty popular. And it's basically, I do so much reading during the week. I usually tweet a lot of the stuff that I'm reading, charts and articles, but I kind of curate the five best things that I found during the week and put those into a Saturday morning email. And at the Felder Report, you can sign up for that. It goes out Saturday mornings and it's totally free.
Jesse, thanks so much for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Are you interested in an alternative asset class that delivers 10 to 25% historical returns? Masterworks.io makes it possible for anyone, retail or accredited, to invest in shares of the world's most valuable paintings from artists like Monet and Basquiat. From 2000 to 2018, art outperformed the S&P by 180%, with almost no correlation to the stock market. Deloitte estimates that there's $1.7 trillion in total wealth held in art, growing to $2.6 trillion by 2026. I recently interviewed Masterworks CEO Scott Lin. I highly recommend you give that episode a listen. We covered the macro argument for investing in fine art and why it should be part of your portfolio. To learn more, head to masterworks.io, select podcast, and use code MACRO to skip the 25,000-person wait list today.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests at macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jesse back on the show. It was interesting to get his take on the gold market. It's interesting that he already is a little concerned that the gold market has gotten ahead of itself. I don't know if I'm so sure that it's, I think there might be a tactical opportunity to get in at these levels as it pulls back. But, you know, time will tell. Anyway, what was your takeaway from the interview?
Well, I'm ahead of him then, because I have been quite certain for months and months and months now that a major technical correction to the downside was coming in gold, and I've also been dead wrong about that. So I'm not going to continue fighting the tape. I do think we, you know, any investor in gold has got to be ready to understand there's been so much upside that there is plenty of room for a big technical correction to the downside. But, you know, it's a buying opportunity. The gold bull market is here to stay, and any significant downside from here is just a buying opportunity as far as I'm concerned. Let's move on, though, to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't yet have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right above Jesse's picture. Patrick, as we dive in and look here at page two, you've got your usual S&P 500 chart, but this week you've added panels for momentum and rate of change, subgraphs. What's going on with this particular chart?
Well, Eric, you know, over the last several months, we've been talking about the parabolic rises in many of these FANG stocks. And usually what you see is an acceleration in the rate of change as they're rising. And I thought it was particularly interesting that we're seeing quite a divergence from what we're seeing in the broader markets. Now, of course, in the very first reaction off of the March lows, when you have such an extreme oversold condition, like we saw during that historic market crash, the reflexivity of an immediate bounce is always going to have a very rapid rate of change. And so expecting the rate of change to shoot higher in the most immediate impulse after a crash is expected. But what we continuously are seeing month after month is the rate of which the stock market is rising is slowing. It's just getting exhausted from this rise. And as it's slowing and slowing, we're seeing all sorts of divergences in the momentum since its July highs, as well as the rate of change is making a sequential series of lower highs and is heading down to the zero line. And traditionally, and one of the really interesting things to watch is traditionally this has and can precede some form of a market correction. And it'll be really interesting now that we're going into the out of the summer doldrums and going into not only the post-Labor Day when there's typically very large amounts of volume, but we also have a big options expiration roll-off. There's a big gamma pinning the S&P in this 3350 to 3400 zone. And so as we roll that off, go into Labor Day, and now several months away from a U.S. election, are we finally going to see some material volatility? I mean, you were referencing the fact that Charlie McElligott was talking about that. And it really, I think, has a very good chance of happening. But when I look at a chart like this, spidey senses are telling that we're probably first going down before we go up.
Well, Patrick, I couldn't agree more that when you see a divergence where the most common names are performing very well and the lesser known names are not performing so well, that breadth divergence is usually a very bearish signal. Let's move on to page 3, where we're looking at a chart showing that the outperformance of the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google. Now, what is this chart telling us? Because on the one hand, I can see that, okay, clearly for the last month, there's been huge outperformance of the FANG stocks compared to other stocks. But you know, if I look back over the last, you know, going all the way back to March, it seems like there have been lots of periods where there was a big outperformance of the FANG stocks, and that would have been that same breadth signal that, maybe would have been bearish, but it didn't really have a bearish outcome. So how should we interpret this now?
First, most basic observation is just how much those 10 companies that make up the FANG plus index, and this is the index future. So it's the normal FANG stocks plus it adds Alibaba, Baidu, Nvidia, Tesla, and Twitter into the FANG basket. And that has been where the vast majority of the performance has happened. And particularly, it's noteworthy that since July, this FANG index has been making higher highs and it's been driving the market higher. But what is particularly interesting to me is that since those July highs, only 3 of these 10 stocks made higher highs. And 2 of them have the stock split momentum of Apple and Tesla, as well Nvidia. And the other 7 have actually not made higher highs. So it's not only that it's a more narrow breadth and it's only the FANG stocks rallying. Actually, in the last month, it's only been a part of the FANG index that's been driving this momentum. And so whenever you see those kind of divergences where fewer and fewer stocks are driving almost all the momentum, to me, that's a red flag. And this is something that it's going to be high on my watch list over the next week or two.
Let's move on to page 4, where you're bringing global equity indices outside the United States and comparing those to the S&P 500.
Right. And everyone is continuously anchoring off U.S. equity markets to already call that this is the end of the bear market and that we're in a new bull market. But when you really look at the global equity markets broadly, they have been massively underperforming and very few have actually even approached their previous highs. So, I mean, when we're looking in the S&P 500 retesting those February highs, it's definitely there. But when you look at something, for instance, take the London FTSE or the Euro stock, they're still materially down and nowhere near their year-to-date starting levels. And at the same time, the Nikkei and even the Canadian TSX, or even if we had up here, let's say the Aussie 200, they're all actually lagging quite considerably. And what's interesting is the emerging markets have done very well, particularly driven, at least on a relative basis, driven by India and Brazil and a few of these other markets that actually have been doing half decently recently, but just today we saw some material breakdowns in the emerging market ETF. And so we're starting to see the global equity feel very toppy and almost rolling over. And it's really the US equity market held up by fewer and fewer stocks that is holding this whole thing up. It would not surprise me at all if we began some sort of mean reverting correction. I don't want to necessarily be saying something overly bearish, like we're going all the way back to previous lows, but it would not surprise me if the break was to the downside coming into the post-Labor Day period.
Let's move on to page 5. You're showing the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield just taking a nosedive, of course, with the pandemic crisis, bottoming out in the bottom of March, great big dead cat bounce back down and retesting that low with a double bottom, then kind of consolidating, looking like it was going to recover up into the middle of June, and then we're back down to new lows as we got into August. So what is going on here with the 10-year, and where are we headed from here?
Well, you know, the one thing, like, I wanted to use the 10-year just simply as a reference point because I want to talk about actually corporate bonds. And so the real takeaway here is that we've been very much stuck in a trade range, but the sequence of lower lows and lower highs has been quite uninterrupted for quite a while. And anyone that's already counting on a major reversal, there isn't, we haven't seen a change in this pattern. I mean, maybe if there's the inflation expectations start to rise in some meaningful way, maybe the yields will start to reflect it. But I don't think that this is yet enough technical evidence to say that some major new trend is developing. But really what I wanted to anchor off of this is the fact that yields are generally pinned lower. And I want to talk about the break that we have seen in the investment grade and junk bond markets over the last couple weeks. So when we go to page 6, you can see the chart there on the investment grade corporate bonds, which had a pretty significant break, wiping out much of the last 1 month's rise in one fluid motion, and has not been really able to start to recover in the last few days off of that. And what's particularly interesting is that the first reaction down was very much in line with that recent little pop in the 10-year Treasury yield. But what's interesting and what will be something that's going to be on my watch list is on page 7 when we're looking at those OAS credit spreads. And you can see those investment grade credit spreads, while they shot up from about 100 basis points to about 400 basis points during the crisis, ever since the Fed stepped in to stabilize the bond markets, those credit spreads have narrowed almost back down to the levels where they were prior to the crisis. And what would be interesting to see is if we see the market start to get nervous and whether or not these credit spreads start to widen again. We haven't seen that break, and that's something that's on my watch list to see whether or not we finally see a turn and whether these start to rise. No sign of it yet.
Let's move on to junk bonds, high yield corporates on page 8. You know, it seemed like we were finally getting that break, I guess, because of the crisis. I wasn't really expecting junk credit to recover from there the way it has. I mean, we're not quite back up to the previous highs, but we're pretty close. What's going on here?
So, Eric, when we're looking at high-yield junk bonds, the one thing that I find really interesting is that they continue to look like they're correlated with the broader equity markets. And when we were showing that rate of change and momentum on the S&P chart earlier, if we were to put them on this high-yield corporate bond chart, you would see the same divergences. And there continues to be the rate of change of the rise slowing. And this, to me, makes it very toppy. It's a market that could very easily roll over. So when we go to page 9 there, we can see that the credit spreads on junk bonds over that of the Treasury before the crisis was around 350, 400 basis points. And we have more or less erased this. And in spite of all of the risks associated with so many of these high yield junk bonds, especially in this post-COVID period where many of these companies that are on the periphery could still realistically default, and there is all sorts of risks associated, much of that risk is not being currently priced into these. We're about 500 basis points above Treasury, which is, to me, a very calm and orderly junk bond market, which I don't think will stay that way.
Well, why don't you think it would stay that way if the Fed is going to continue to bail it out? I mean, it seems to me like what changed here is the Fed announcing that they're going to buy junk bonds with taxpayer money, which I think is completely immoral and illegal, but it doesn't slow them down.
Well, I think there's a difference between the Fed providing liquidity to keep an orderly market versus them directly trying to manipulate junk bond yields so that low-grade credit companies can access the debt markets and borrow at rates much lower than they should be. I don't actually think that there's a lot of moral hazard, just like you're suggesting. And I don't think it's the intention of the Fed necessarily to somehow manipulate these interest rates lower. Rather, I think it was the fact that the ETFs have just become so big that there was a real liquidity risk if they didn't provide liquidity into that market. So I actually still think that there's plenty of room for junk bonds to actually have a freakout moment. I think everyone's getting a little too complacent about that.
Well, we'll see what happens. Let's move on to volatility on page 10 with the VIX index. What's going on here? And what's the blue consolidation range telling us at the bottom? Looks like we're coming back into it.
Well, this is the thing. When you go back and look at even the last 2-3 years of the bull market prior to this drop, we saw volatility stay consistently in the 10 to 20% range where it consolidated in that period where we saw everyone generally being short gamma in a very big way. Since the crisis, volatility has been narrowing or coming off of its major crash highs. And the question now is this now going to stay at an elevated level of volatility, or are we genuinely in some sort of new bull market where volatility will come back into this traditional long-term range? I personally think that this is a very important moment. And when you look on page 11, what I did here was compare the S&P 500 implied volatility and compare that to the 30-day and 100-day actually realized volatility. And what we can see is what's been dragging on this lower has a particularly that 30-day volatility, because of this narrow range the stock market has been in into the summer, has been dragging realized volatility down, which is keeping implieds very low. But going into a U.S. election and a post-Labor Day liquidity surge that I think will potentially drive some material volatility, I think that this realistically could be the bottom end range of implied volatilities in the VIX, and we could potentially see volatility return in the coming months. And so this is one of the really interesting things to watch.
Patrick, we got to touch on gold before we finish. On page 12 here, you've got the gold chart, and you tell me, but you know, as I look at this chart, I can see the consolidation range, and you know, it looks to me like the top of that consolidation range, you could call it anywhere from 1765 up to 1800, but let's say just because the market has been strong, I wouldn't want to pick a low number to wait for it to come down to, but it seems to me like it's reasonable to expect a technical correction to come back down to something just above 1800 before this market marches higher. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you, my intuition is that the bull market's not over. And what I feel like in a traditional consolidation, and especially if it zigzags downward, you can see one more drop here that could potentially see like 1850. And definitely, if it was a bull market, we should stay above those consolidation highs of April and May. So printing below 1800, even if it temporarily drops below 1850, it shouldn't stay down there very long if it is going to be bullish. The characteristic that you typically want to see in a proper bull market is that all dips are being aggressively bought, which is that they don't stay down very long, even if they do break. And that's actually what I'm going to be watching for. Is that characteristic of buying dips going to remain there? Or is this going to become far more distributive in its price action, which means that maybe some sort of bigger or more prolonged intermediate high is in place that will lead to a multi-month correction in gold? And I'm not totally sure I'm sold on which one. My intuition and benefit of the doubt goes to the fact that the bulls will buy the dip here. And I think that if the market was to gift a technical drop down to like 1850, it's an interesting place to be buying, calling for the next leg higher. So that's definitely what I'm watching. But I wanted to, on chart 13, ask you. You asked us to put this chart in there. What are you showing here on page 13?
Well, Patrick, this gets a little bit more technical. We're getting now into the term structure of the gold futures market, the difference between one delivery contract and the next in terms of price. And, you know, it astonishes me what it is about the gold market that causes there to be more misinformation than accurate information on the internet. I just don't know. I was really disappointed to see Zero Hedge run an article recently by some clown talking about how the deep backwardation in the gold market portends a signal of shortages and so forth. There's absolutely no backwardation in the gold market. The gold market is not only in a very steep contango, it's in a situation where the contango is greater than what's known as full carry, or in the oil market, what a lot of people like to call super contango. In other words, if you were to buy the December 2020 gold futures contract and take delivery of gold on that contract, put it in storage. Well, what's it going to cost you to store that gold? Somewhere around 50 to 75 basis points if you're an institutional account. So you figure that we're talking about, you know, between $10 and $15 an ounce that it's going to cost to store the gold for a year. You've got to finance the purchase of that gold if you're going to evaluate the carrying cost. But, you know, the cost of Treasury bills now is, you know, what, 10 basis points or something? So it's almost negligible. So you would expect that the maximum contango, what's called fair value or full carry, is somewhere around $15 to $20. If the 2021 gold contract is more than about $15 to $20 higher than the 2020 contract, it's creating a risk-free arbitrage where you can make a guaranteed profit without taking any risk on what the price of gold does, simply by buying the 2020, selling the 2021, which means you make, what was at one point, a $46 differential. You put that in your pocket, and all you got to do is pay to store the gold for a year, which is going to cost you 15 or 20 bucks. You end up pocketing 25 bucks. That's a guaranteed return of about 2%. Now, 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but this is essentially a risk-free guaranteed return. In order to not make that return, the exchange has to completely collapse. And so if you look at the other risk-free returns, which are treasury returns that are yielding just a few basis points, it's a really big deal. How do we get down to the point where there was a $46 difference between the 20 and 21 December contracts? I talked to Kevin Muir a little bit off the air about this. He did some checking around. Kevin thinks what's going on here is the traders who know how to put that trade on are mostly bullion bank traders. And a lot of those guys have kind of had their capital chopped off because of the Volcker rule and just restructuring of their banks. You can make guaranteed money on this, but it's capital intensive. You got to buy a whole bunch of gold and sell the futures contract, and you end up making a guaranteed return of 2%. Well, they don't have their own company's capital, and they have to go out to their customers and try to find somebody that wants that 2% guaranteed return, and they're apparently not finding it. Looks like what happened is that got to the point where the extreme contango was so far beyond a full carry at $46. Somehow that trade finally caught on. A bunch of people realized, hey, there's free money on the table here to arbitrage this inefficiency, and that's why you see the steep recovery. I think the reason that this is interesting to retail investors and sophisticated private investors is the usual trade-off is, you know, you can buy the ETF or you can buy physical. Now, physical has a lot of advantages. It means you're completely independent from the financial system. You're not dependent on the stock market still being there for your ETF shares to be worth something. But if you're talking about, you know, just a few thousand dollars that you could store in your home, then I guess it doesn't cost you anything. For any appreciable amount of capital, you would never want to store it in your home because bad guys will find out you got gold and come and kill you and your family in order to get it. So you got to pay about 75 basis points to store it. So if you want physical, it always costs more than paper gold. For the first time, really, that I can remember, physical costs cheaper. The carrying cost of buying and storing physical gold in a private vault where you own it and you're completely independent of the financial system is actually lower than buying the futures contract. or a paper instrument that trades the futures contract. So where a lot of people used to be just totally, you know, it's got to be physical metal stored in a vault. And I used to say, look, I just don't think the COMEX is going to go out of business. I'm comfortable making my gold investments by carrying futures contracts. It's actually cheaper to do it in the physical market now, or even with an ETF, actually, like GLD, which owns all of the gold as opposed to using futures contracts. Futures have become very efficient because of this arbitrage that hadn't been taken. Now, it is starting to come back out. It's going to be very interesting to see whether it comes completely back out. Patrick, before we close, let's hit page 14. What can our listeners do if they want to get in on a free trial to your service, Big Picture Trading?
If anyone is interested in just seeing what I do on a regular daily basis, where I analyze the macro markets and call all sorts of trades, you can sign up for a free trial with no credit card required at bigpicturetrading.com.
We're going to leave it there. This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Masterworks.io. See disclaimer at masterworks.io/disclaimer. And by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the post game. There is also a link to a number of Jesse Felder reports, as well as a link to a great interview with Russell Napier about central banks having become irrelevant. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.